Good morning. Let's open in a word of prayer. Father, thank you so much for your word and your gracious gift that you have outlined for us, things that we can expect to be going through in the period of time leading up to the return of Jesus Christ to set up his kingdom. Pray that you will bless us this week. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, this week I borrowed a title from the new issue of Foreign Affairs, titled, What Are We Missing? It's kind of interesting because the theme is, you know, here's a guy who's about ready to get hit by a meteor, and he's looking at his cell phone or looking out and, you know, with his binoculars out towards what's going on, and he's kind of missing the big thing that's coming. And their question is, what are we missing predicting the next crisis? Now, of course, Foreign Affairs is a globalist, New World Order type organization. The publication is put out by the Council on Foreign Relations. And you would expect them to have an orientation towards setting up a global government, that sort of thing. But they're also like, what's the next crisis? And it's clear from this crisis that regardless of how you consider the genesis of the crisis to have come about with the coronavirus and the economic carnage that's ensued, the question is, or certainly what we can observe, is that people wanted to take advantage of this. They were ready to take advantage of any crisis. Whether they specifically planned this crisis or not, there are plenty of things that could come upon the world that people and governments plan for. But clearly, once this was underway, they stepped in to do all sorts of draconian things, leading to even the World Economic Forum putting out this vision that they have about a Great Reset. So today we're going to take a look at a little bit. We're going to take a look a little bit at the election that's coming up. We're going to take a look at, I think, a sort of a looming issue that's related to that is the influence of Red China. Take a look at some cultural things, and then we will focus on some rather significant developments in the Middle East. And these are the things that we won't be missing this week, but there's plenty, believe me, there does seem to be no lack of things to talk about, to analyze, to try to go into depth on. So I'm trying to take a sort of more of a general overview, but maybe talk a little bit in depth about a couple of things. We talk each week about the convergence of events, and each week I keep saying that appears to be a world that is not disrupted, then I may stop using this slide. Also, a reminder that the updates are put up on an alternative platform, Remnant Truth Network, rtntv.org, and there is an app there. I use this verse most weeks, and I think it would apply here. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lust shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned unto fables. Now that verse is specifically directed to the church, and we see people in the church that are directing their ears towards fables, such as critical race theory, social justice, and that sort of thing. I talked about that a couple weeks ago when I talked about James chapter 2. And I think that is entirely true, but it's also true in the culture that people are turning to fables or trying to prevent you from finding out information about things. I mean, I talked this week about truth lockdown. And that was even more apparent this week as people continued to resist things. So what are we missing? First, let's talk a little bit about the election here in the United States. This is Foreign Policy's magazine, current issue, the most important election ever. I don't know that I disagree with that. I think that that might be an accurate assessment. And everybody has an opinion. Do you think that we're sort of divided as a culture on this particular issue? I'm going to show you some things, but one of the things that's come out is the Hunter Biden laptop. And there's all sorts of, I think, solid speculation that, well, first of all, I don't think it's speculation that it's Hunter Biden's laptop. It is Hunter Biden's laptop. It is impossible. And I, as an attorney, I've had to deal with electronic discovery on a number of issues where we get tens, thousands, millions of emails produced, and all of the emails have metadata with them, so you can determine their origin. I don't think that anyone in the Biden camp that I'm aware of has denied that the laptop or hard drives were not Hunter Biden's hard drives. In fact, I believe his attorney sent an email to someone saying, please give his laptop back. Well, if it wasn't his laptop, why was he paying his attorney to do that, to ask for the laptop back? And there's allegations of some pretty graphic sexual encounters that, I guess that's involving young girls, that Hunter Biden had him smoking crack, that type of thing. But there was also a business associate who came out and did a pretty extensive news conference. And he said, I have 12 cell phones. These are all my cell phones. These are not Russian cell phones. National security people, I heard one interview this week, they said, look, it's impossible to create a total fake laptop with the, you know, millions of bits of information on it. It's just not possible for them to do that. It would take a team of people working many, many years to do that. So I don't doubt the authenticity of that laptop. And this person who came out, his last name begins with a K, I can't remember the name, but he was quite direct that, you know, listen, the big guy was Joe Biden, and it was clear that we were not supposed to talk about Joe Biden. And a lot of what was done was to funnel money from these various countries to Joe Biden and his family. And the question always remains, and I sort of watch this with politicians in all parties, these people go and they make salaries. Their salaries might be $125,000, $140,000, $200,000 a year, but they're worth tens of millions of dollars after a career in government service. And they funnel contracts to their family. Dianne Feinstein's husband has gotten incredibly wealthy. I believe he's a commercial realtor, and he sold post offices and that type of thing and gotten a commission. And it just so happens that when they have to do those things out on the West Coast, her husband happens to get hired by the federal government to sell buildings where he can make a commission. I'm sure it's just coincidental. I'm sure it has nothing to do with her position and that sort of thing. And she's not very popular now because she actually hugged Lindsey Graham. I guess that's verboten. It looks like Amy Coney Barrett, by the way, is going to get approved in a vote maybe as early as tomorrow. I saw that Linda Murkowski, the senator from Alaska, who caucuses with the Republicans, I'm not sure why, but she's actually said that she's going to vote for her. So that pretty much makes it a lock. And we'll see how it goes. I'm sure that Judge Barrett will, as Justice Barrett, will probably issue some decisions that we may not like. But I would say that in my lifetime, outside of Judge Scalia and Justice Scalia and Justice Alito, she's probably one that tracks my own personal judicial philosophy of being an originalist and textualist in terms of the Constitution, like it actually means things and that you shouldn't be changing it. But back to Biden and the influence. Of course, there were millions of dollars transferred by Ukraine, but also Red China. Claudia Rosette, a few weeks ago, about 2.5 weeks ago, in the Wall Street Journal, wrote an article about China is using the UN to expand its surveillance reach. And I think the graphic there on the right is an excellent graphic showing that, you know, China really is trying to take things over, and they're trying to use their money and influence. And this has long been the plan of Xi to do this. Here's what Claudia Rosette says in her article, at least the first couple paragraphs. While the U.S. is trying to limit, this was in the Wall Street Journal, so it'd probably be behind a paywall. While the U.S. is trying to limit data flows to Beijing, the United Nations Secretariat in New York is working with Beijing to set up a joint global data hubs based in China. Plans include a research center for crunching data from UN member states in a geospatial center to unleash China's prowess with satellite surveillance. Officially, the aim is to streamline and enhance the UN's increasingly data-driven projects. This China-UN complex would be integrated into the UN's Master Plan for Global Development, Agenda 2030. This entails 17 broad sustainable development goals. We've talked about these in the past, such as ending poverty and achieving, quote, peace and justice. Having run into difficulties collecting the desired data, the UN is on a campaign to boost reporting and unify standards across its 193 member states and throughout its sprawling agencies, departments, and initiatives. China, the world's leading high-tech surveillance state, is happy to help. Arrangements for the UN, for the China-UN Big Data Partnership are being finalized. The leader of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping, announced in his speech on September 22 to the UN General Assembly, promising to support the UN in playing its central role in international affairs. And there is now been issued, there's this thing called, it's a memorandum of understanding between the UN and China about collecting data. Now, how many of you think that this is actually going to be a good thing for personal privacy and freedom? China, the place where they already have social credit scores. And frankly, I think that Twitter and Facebook have fully signed on to the China social credit score, and that's why people have a tendency to get banned and blocked, shadow banned and that type of thing on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and elsewhere if they're sending out if they're sending out anything that has any kind of conservative viewpoint that wouldn't square with the fascists that run YouTube, Google, Facebook, and Twitter, who, by the way, were given special privileges by the federal government if they would be open platforms, and they are hardly anything but open platforms. And you're going to, I think the next week and 2 days until the election and after, you're going to see really draconian lockdowns of people sharing information that doesn't match their official narrative. So China has really tried to get into a position where it can dominate the world, and this is sort of the Chinese mindset that they want to do. This COVID thing, I personally think it's a bioweapon, and I think it was engineered and designed to increase China's influence. And when you look at the way things have gone in the economic world, China is probably recovering better than just about anybody else right at the present time. Again, I'm sure that's just an accident. But there is a concerted effort. Now, there were some things that happened back in the Obama administration, of which Joe Biden was an integral part, relative to China. Some of the reporting on this did not take place, though, until after Trump was sworn in early 2017. In fact, there was a report, this came from Reuters, this was published May 21st, 2017, about four months after President Trump was inaugurated. And it said, China systematically crippled CIA operations, killing or imprisoning up to 20 sources. Now, you might look at that article and say, oh, well, it's 2017. It's after President Trump came in, and we know, you know, what's the old saying, loose lips sink ships, and President Trump didn't understand national security and that sort of thing. But they, what happened was this information started coming out after the change in administration that a significant number of intelligence assets, meaning people that were providing intelligence in China, had been identified, outed, and killed during the Obama administration back in 2010 and 2011, during the time that a person named Hillary Clinton ran the United States State Department. I've talked about this previously. The State Department intelligence agencies were either negligent or intentionally non-observant in watching over these intelligent assets, and there were some estimate at least 10 to 12 assets were arrested and executed by the Chinese government. Other numbers I've seen put the up to 3 or 4 dozen, but effectively what it did was it crippled the U.S.'s, the United States' ability to conduct intelligence in China, and I don't know that we've recovered yet. And this is how the Chinese, this is how they roll. This is how they do things. And so now we have pretty good evidence that millions of dollars were funneled to the Biden family. It is also true that similar to this memorandum of understanding, during the course of the Obama administration, I believe under the direction of Joe Biden, who happened to be handling the China negotiations, a memorandum of understanding was entered into between the United States and China to allow Chinese companies, many of which were government-owned, access to United States capital markets. They were given access to these markets, but they were not required to have the accounting and reporting requirements that are imposed on United States companies that are in the capital markets. So the Chinese companies came in without these, and it's estimated by some, I heard an interview with Frank Gaffney the other day, and I can't remember who he was talking to. Gordon Chang talks about this, Fred Flights, other people on Secure Freedom Radio quite a bit. But they estimate that probably over $3 trillion of U.S. investor money, many of these are pension funds and that sort of thing, have been directed towards Chinese companies that have no obligation to engage in fair accounting or meet the accounting standards of American companies, yet they're allowed to have people's retirement assets and that type of thing invested in their companies. And it is a, and there's been some examples of billions of dollars of essentially theft that's taken place with some of these Chinese companies that have gone under. That all happened to be done with the blessing of a guy named Joe Biden. It is shocking to me that the Democrats have not pulled him off the ticket. By the way, does he have a running mate? Because I watch a lot of the election news. Did somebody kidnap Kamala Harris after the Pence debate? I haven't seen, have you seen her? Is she in the basement with Joe Biden? I hope not, but for her sake, but his too, now that I think about it. Maybe they should both be in the basement. You know, I had a case many years ago, this is off the track, but there were two guys, they hated each other, and I was involved in sort of breaking up a family, getting somebody, representing one side and breaking up a family partnership, and the heads of the families were in court over another business that they jointly owned, and the judge threw them in contempt, in jail for contempt, because they were just nasty in the courtroom. And he said, you're going to spend the weekend in jail. And some people said that the mistake that the judge made was he did not sentence them to be spend the weekend in jail in the same cell, because that might have solved the problem. I've never really seen anything like it. So we have this major problem. We have one party who is beholden to China. It's I have to tell you, I've never seen anything like it. And I hope I never see anything like it again, but I'm afraid that if there is another presidential election in the United States, and I say that with some seriousness, I wonder, you always say, well, it couldn't get worse, right? Well, yeah, it really could get worse. So here we have a number of examples of how China has gotten away with things, with their companies coming into capital markets, their ability to systematically rip up the CIA operations in China by killing off intelligent assets. And it's a major problem. And as a result of this, as some refer to it, the Chinese Communist Party coronavirus, now there are, I don't know how else to describe it, rather draconian lockdowns taking place all across Europe right now for at least the next 3 weeks. Belgium, there are outbreaks of it. There are concerns about hospital capacity and that type of thing. The United Kingdom is in a series of lockdowns. I saw a report, this is just a screenshot from a Sky News Australia report on The Outsiders. I'd highly recommend it if you're conservative. They're very open about what they say. And that one of the questions they asked on their show just the other day was, is, you know, Kamala Harris in some kind of witness protection program, because she seems to have disappeared. And here's a screenshot from a report that they had yesterday or today about the lockdown that's going on in Wales. And you see there, this is a grocery store where they have blocked off all sorts of different parts of the store. You're not allowed to buy any of those things. And the people, they interviewed somebody in Wales, and he said, it's unbelievable what's going on here. I mean, you're not allowed, if you go to Wales, there are actually police at the, I didn't even know there was really a border, but there's police at the border between England and Wales turning people around and sending them back. And it's absolutely shocking. At the same time that's going on, we have this continuing thing with Black Lives Matter. For example, President Shapiro at Northwestern University was pressured to defund the Northwestern University Police Department in Evanston, Illinois. And you might remember there are some leading lights of leftism and socialism that were at Northwestern. I don't know if she's still there, but Bernadine Dorn, who was one of the Weathermen Underground, who killed people, were terrorists. She was a professor of law at the Northwestern University. And I know people who send their kids there $80,000 a year. Another person I know, his son was taking a 2-year Master of Business Administration program. The cost was $200,000. Now, as you know, Northwestern University is in the Big Ten, and they've never been that good of a football team, but their cheer used to be at games when they were getting beat up by the likes of Ohio State and other teams, was, that's all right, that's okay, you'll all be working for us someday. So Shapiro, the president, was being pressured to defund, completely disband New Northwestern University Police Department, and he responded with some Twitter posts and emails and said, no way. In fact, you people are you're not acting the right way, and you need to clean up your act. Well, now they've been out chanting at his house in the middle of the night and that type of thing. And so this is the next step of what they're going to do, is this doxing thing. I mentioned the kid in Bakersfield who had put up a sign, and we can say, okay, he shouldn't have put up that sign about Black Lives Matter, his opinion of it, the organization. But what happened with him was he was doxed by a girl in his Christian school classroom. They exposed all of his personal information, and he received hundreds of death threats. because of these Black Lives Matter and Antifa activists, which I guess to Joe Biden are only ideas, they threatened to kill him. And this is what they're doing. Here's a picture of, this was Andy Ngo at, who follows this, he's sort of a citizen journalist out in Portland and Seattle. And this is someone who is, I think this is in Seattle. She is saying, listen, you know, you guys are, they're playing loud music and that type of thing. You need to turn the music down and go home. I live here. And the response was, I can't even say to you what the response to her was. This is on a video. We're going to come get you. We have you on video. We're gonna dox you. We're going to find out where you are. If you don't think this is a problem or this is the mindset, I wrestled with whether I should play this or not because I think this person is mentally unbalanced, yet he continues to work for major networks. His name is Keith Olbermann, and here's what he had to say about the election.
There can be no mistaking what is ahead of us in this best of possible scenarios, a period in which a Trump-led minority will continue to terrorize this country. And Trump, whose only barely human delight comes from the applause of the morons in the crowd, will seek that pleasure again and endlessly until the day he dies. We unleash this terrorism via the activating mechanism of reality television. Trump unleashed his terrorists via the activating mechanism of encouraging them to hate. Trump can be and must be expunged. The hate he has triggered, the Pandora's box he has opened, they will not be so easily destroyed. So, let us brace ourselves. The task is twofold. The terrorist Trump must be defeated, must be destroyed, must be devoured at the ballot box. And then he and his enablers and his supporters and his collaborators and the Mike Lees and the William Barrs and the Sean Hannitys and the Mike Pences and the Rudy Giulianis and the Kyle Rittenhouses and the Amy Coney Barretts must be prosecuted and convicted and removed from our society while we try to rebuild it and to rebuild the world Trump has nearly destroyed by turning it over to a virus. Remember it. Even as we dream of a return to reality and safety and the country for which our forefathers died, that the fight is not just to win an election, but to win it by enough to chase, at least for a moment, Trump and the maggots off the stage and then try to clean up what they left. Remember it, even though to remember it means remembering that the fight does not end November 3rd, but in many ways will only begin that day.
Well, now, you know, there's some comments that you could make about that. And one is the frightening thing is he may actually be on medication. He actually may be medicated. You know, this man is, but he's on these networks. It's unbelievable. I don't know. But I don't think that he's way outside the mainstream on this is my problem. Remember Robert Reich, the diminutive, I guess we would describe him, former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton, was it Clinton or Obama? Clinton administration. Now professor, I think, at Harvard or instructor at Harvard, tweeted this the other, about a week ago, when this nightmare is over, we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It would erase Trump's lies, comfort those who have been harmed by his hatefulness, and name every official, politician, executive, and media mogul whose greed and cowardice enabled this catastrophe. See, that's why I don't think that things are going to be very calm here in the United States over the next few months, at least. That's the optimistic John talking when he says few months. Now, look, I don't lay awake at night thinking about it. But I do plan, you know, how I'm going to go about life if things are difficult. And you should do the same as well. Tucker Carlson the other night had a little interview. You'll see the guy's name from Revolver News, who's immediately now described. He's an ultra-right winger. The arch-conservative, ultra, did they ever say this about ultra left winger, you know, fascist Marxist? No, they never say this. It's like a person of the center left. There's nobody that is way on the left. They're just center left. But he's talking about a reporter. I want you to see this about this reporter for NBC News. She works, this is what she does for her job.
Brandi Zadrozny is a, quote, reporter with NBC News. What does she do exactly? Well, by her description, her job is seeking out personally identifying information about anonymous Trump supporters online, some of them, and revealing their true identities. Zadrozny has acknowledged, quote, this, I use social media sleuthing to learn about a subject's real life, their family, friends, jobs, personal and political associations. So what does that mean exactly? What kind of information? Well, that information could include phone records, property records, even their Amazon wish lists. What is this about exactly? Darren Beatty is one of the people who broke this story. He's with Revolver News. Darren, thanks so much for joining us. So before you get into the larger meaning of this, tell us specifically what this, what is she doing? What does this mean?
Oh, she's up to no good. As you mentioned, she uses state-of-the-art proprietary technical tools to dig up personal information about anonymous Trump supporters online. As you mentioned, that includes property records, phone records, even Amazon wish lists, you name it. She'll do everything she can to unearth anonymous Trump supporters, basically so she can ruin their lives.
Why would NBC News be doing something like this? I mean, you'd think NBC's job would be to tell us the news. What do the policies mean? Why would they be going after anonymous Twitter users?
It's a great question. It really is disgusting. It's disgraceful, even by modern journalist standards. I'd love for NBC to comment on this. We see these journalists are not even acting as meaningful journalists. What they're doing is acting as commissars, a neo-Stasi, effectively, in order to crush the rebellion of the American people against their corrupt ruling class associated with the victory of Donald Trump. There's one aspect of this story that's maybe even more disturbing than what you described, and that is that Brandi Zadrozny uses this term disinformation as the pretext to go after Trump supporters and destroy their lives. I think as many viewers have seen, disinformation is this new buzzword, this new pretext used to silence Trump supporters. What's especially dangerous about this is that it brings this forced to bear in a national security context. Disinformation is a national security term. It invites the force of our own national security apparatus to silence Trump supporters domestically. And it's part of this trend that we're seeing, a broader swath of our own national security apparatus being repurposed and redeployed domestically to silence, suppress, and destroy the energies associated with Donald Trump's victory in 2016.
For a news organization to work in concert with the federal agencies to suppress dissent domestically, I mean, that's, I never imagined that would happen, but that is happening.
Right. The full story of this, I would need hours to explain, but just a little detail. So she wrote for her fellow journalists, a manual, a doxing manual, detailing her methods for fellow journalists who failed the same ethics class. One of the sponsors of her doxing manual on how to ruin Trump supporters' lives by uncovering their personal information is Bellingcat, an organization funded by NED and our own government. Taxpayers are funding this.
It's unbelievable. Noah Oppenheim at NBC News, one of the people who should answer, the guy who apparently leaked the Access Hollywood tape to the Washington Post in 2016. They never have to answer the question.
Absolutely.
Darren Beatty, great to see you tonight. Congrats on the story.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And that just scratches the surface. So just be prepared that this is what one of the tactics is. This is NBC News that has a person to do this. And I drive around, and I know there are people here, they might have a Trump sign in their yard, and the signs are regularly defaced, torn down, painted, and with some pretty explicit words on them. I do think that we're in for some real turmoil, unless the election is just so clear. And now I'm here that you know, over 50 million people have already voted already, which is many, many times more than have voted in any election early in the history of the United States. 50 million. I've also heard that some people, based on some of the things that have come out about Biden or having buyers, they wish they could go back and redo their vote. That's one of the problems with voting early. But, and then, of course, the mail-in ballots continue to be a major problem. Last week, I mentioned that this was going on at the White House, or at the Vatican. This is a Amazonian fertility goddess on the right, and on the left is a new Vatican coin. Do you see the similarities between the two? That the Vatican, the seat of the head of the Roman Catholic Church in the world, has put on a coin a Amazon fertility goddess who's giving birth to a new world. And this is consistent with what the Pope has said. The Pope came out this week, and there was an interview that he gave to a newspaper last fall in which he expressed some support for same-sex marriage. The Vatican immediately tried to suppress that information. I think I was able to get the article before it was taken down. It was done by a left-wing journalist and a homosexual pro-gay guy. And he got the Pope to say this. And then the Vatican immediately came out and said, oh, no, he didn't say that. Well, now there's been a new, there's been a new documentary that's come out. And it is a documentary about, it's called Francesco. Excuse me one second. I just have to change a couple slides. And in this new documentary, this quote of the Pope is, this is what he says. And this is from the Catholic News Agency. Pope Francis calls for civil union law for same-sex couples in shift from Vatican stance. Here's a screenshot of the documentary, which has been published in Italy, will come to the United States after the election. And supposedly he says this, and this is the quote that is in the video translation of it. Homosexuals have a right to be a part of the family. They're children of God and have a right to a family. Nobody should be thrown out or be made to be miserable because of it. What we have to create is a civil union law. That way they are legally covered. I stood up for that. The film chronicles the approach of Pope Francis to pressing social issues and to pastoral ministry among those who live, in the words of the pontiff, on the existential peripheries. Now, this is not new that the LGBT community has viewed this pope as someone who's going to change their doctrine. This is the Advocate back in 2013. He was, in that year, he was called the Person of the Year. And you'll see that they have their, you see the NO and H8, no hate. That was to vote no on Proposition 8, which was overturned in California back in 2010. It was passed overwhelmingly in California and then overturned by a court, which shows the importance of courts. Well, there's been a lot of reaction to what the Pope said. Archbishop Vigano, who's actually, my understanding is, he's been in hiding since 2018. He did make an appearance at a conference just down the road over in Pittsburgh on Friday or Saturday. This is what the article says. Archbishop Vergano, an ultra-conservative Italian critic of the Pope who has accused Francis of pandering to gay groups, was upset by the Pope's message. In an opinion piece published Wednesday on the Church Militant website, which is popular among traditional Catholics, he said, "One does not have to be a theologian or a moral expert to know that such statements are totally heterodox and constitute a very serious cause of scandal for the faithful. But pay careful attention. These words simply constitute the umpteenth provocation by which the ultra-progressive part of the hierarchy wants to artfully provoke a schism, as it always tried to do with the post-synodal exhortation, Amoris Laetitia, the modification of doctrine on the death penalty. Also on the Pan-Amazon Synod and the filthy Pacamama, that's the one that I just showed you the picture of, and the Abu Dhabi Declaration, which has now been reaffirmed and aggravated by the encyclical Fratelli Tutti, or Brothers, is the translation. It appears that Bergoglio is impudently trying to raise the stakes in a crescendo of heretical affirmations in such a way that it will force the healthy part of the church, which includes bishops, clergy, and faithful, to accuse him of heresy in order to declare that the healthy part of the church is schismatic and the enemy of the Pope. Bergoglio, Pope Francis, is trying to force some cardinals and bishops to separate themselves from communion with him, obtaining as a result not his own deposition for heresy, but rather the expulsion of Catholics who want to remain faithful to the perennial magisterium of the church. This trap would have the purpose and the presumed intentions of Bergoglio and his magic circle of consolidating his own power within a church that would only nominally be Catholic, but in reality would be heretical and schismatic." I think this is important. Now listen, you know my feelings about Catholics and their need to understand and believe the true gospel of Jesus Christ, but I think what you're seeing here is even among Catholics, there is very grave concern about this Pope. He's a leftist. He's a Marxist. He's a radical leftist. He's Catholicism and the robes and stuff that he wears, they're physical props. So he can get away with tearing down this institution. Bergoglio says this: "This deception draws on the support of the globalist elites." Vergano says this: "This deception draws on the support of the globalist elites, the mainstream media, and the LGBT lobby, to which many clergy, bishops, and cardinals are no strangers. Furthermore, let us not forget that in many nations there are laws in force that criminally punish anyone who considers sodomy reprehensible and sinful who does not approve of the legitimization of homosexual matrimony, even if they do so on the basis of their creed." And this is what's happened in the European Union. You can believe that. You can never express it publicly. You have freedom of religion. You're free to believe this, but you can't. There's no free exercise of religion or discussion. So they talk about there's a Catholic deep state. So you can get that at Church Militant on Vergano. This is very troubling. In fact, Vergano said, I don't remember if it was in this article or another article or in his talk at this conference over in Pittsburgh the other day, said this: "The end times are now approaching before our eyes." Now, his theology is this. He believes the Catholic Church is the restrainer, the protector against the revelation of all kinds of manner of evil and the son of perdition. And that now the restrainer is being removed by the actions of this particular pope. And essentially what he says is, when this happens, it's the end times and all hell's going to break loose on the earth. So pray for Archbishop Vergano and his salvation. And but I have to say, I think that he is on track here. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about how the popes and other thinkings have an effect, but that will be in the context of some of my other comments here. So let's look at some of the other things that have gone on. Now earlier this week, it was Well, there was one other thing, too, that the Pope did. He's been a busy boy the last couple of weeks, and a bad one, a bad busy boy. He put in place, or there was back in May, they were supposed to have this global compact on education that was to take place at the Vatican, and all these educators and everybody were going to come in the world, and they were going to train them in social justice and Marxism and all this other stuff. Well, fortunately, it had to be canceled. But this week they held it virtually, and this is the headlines that they came up with. Global Compact on Education, and the title of the headline there, this is in the Vatican newspaper or Roman newspaper, religious newspaper, it says a global pact against catastrophe. In other words, we have to re-educate people and reimagine you see, you hear this in Black Lives Matter and Antifa all the time. We have to reimagine policing. We have to reimagine education because we have to change the world. We have to change the way people thinking. We have to get rid of these this is Marxism. We have to tear down what's in place to build up our utopia. And if people get in the way, they're not just going to dox them. They're going to come after them. And the Pope is behind this. In his talk that he gave at this conference, he had called for, and you can see what this is sort of the video, you can find it on the Global Compact for Education website. He called for a new cultural model. So he's going to be pushing this. He said this: to educate is always an act of hope, one that calls for cooperation and turning a barren and paralyzing indifference into another way of thinking that recognizes our interdependence. If our educational systems are presently marked by a mindset of replacement and repetition, are incapable of opening up new horizons in which hospitality, intergenerational solidarity, and the value of transcendence can give birth to a new culture, would this not signify that we are failing to take advantage of the opportunity offered by this historic moment? And he talks about changing paradigms and reimagining things. He then cites his own encyclical, this Fratelli Tutti, that he came out with early, about 3 weeks ago today, actually. And he makes some of these in his speech. He gives this in the first Christian century. Listen, this is what they do. They changed the Bible, right? In the first Christian centuries, a number of thinkers developed a universal vision of their reflections on the common destination of created goods. This led them to realize that if one person lacks what is necessary to live with dignity, it is because another person is detaining it. For my part, I would observe that the Christian tradition has never recognized the right to private property as absolute or inviolable, and has stressed the social purpose of all forms of private property. The principle of the common use of created goods is the first principle in the whole ethical and social order. It is a natural and inherent right that takes priority over others. He is a liar. He comes up with some different things. So these are number 6 and 7 that he proposes. To be committed to finding new ways of understanding the economy. New ways of understanding. This is classical UN sustainable development goals, all the same. New ways of understanding the economy, politics, growth, and progress. That can truly stand at the service of the human person and the entire human family within the context of an integral ecology. He needs a better speechwriter too. 7th, to safeguard and cultivate our common home, protecting it from the exploitation of its resources, and to adopt a more sober lifestyle marked by the use of renewable energy resources and respect for the natural and human environment in accordance with the principles of subsidiarity, solidarity, and a circular economy. Finally, dear brothers and sisters, we want to commit ourselves courageously to developing an educational plan within our respective countries, investing our best energies and introducing creative and transformative processes in cooperation with civil society. And this, our point of reference, should be the social doctrine that, inspired by the revealed word of God in Christian humanism, provides a solid basis and vital resource for discerning the past to follow in the present emergency. Christian humanism. So this is what he's doing. So this is, and so again, he did the homosexual thing. So let's look at something else that I think is pretty important. Well, actually, this is something that came out from the EU last month. Being yourself is not your ideology, it's your identity, and no one can ever take it away. We will soon present a strategy to strengthen LGBTQI rights. Now, I'm losing track of what all the initials mean. Okay, I know Q is questioning, or queer. See, it's not, it's always, it's ambiguous. This does have an impact, though. This is an article. This is Rod Dreher, who I believe is Catholic, but and I don't agree with everything that he says. But he makes this. He writes at the American Conservative in an article published on October 22nd. No families, no future, no children. Look at what he says in his opening paragraph. Here's a fascinating article from New York Magazine on the massive gender gap between Trump and Biden supporters. It contains this eye-popping claim buried deep down. And now he's quoting from the Intelligencer article at the New York Magazine publication. Neither the societal shift away from the traditional gender roles or the downstream cultural consequences of that shift are anywhere near complete. As Rebecca Traister has incisively argued, the growing prevalence of singledom among Americans' rising generation of women is one of the most potent forces in contemporary politics. In 2009, for the first time in history, there were more unmarried women in the United States than married ones. And today, young women in the U.S. aren't just unprecedentedly single, they also appear to be unprecedentedly uninterested in heterosexuality. According to private polling shared with Intelligencer by Democratic data scientist David Shore, roughly 30% of American women under 25 identify as LGBT. Are you processing that? Dreher goes on to say, has anything like this ever happened to any society ever? 3 out of 10 women under the age of 25 consider themselves to be gay or transgender. 5%? Sure. Maybe even 8%, but 30? Will they always think that? Maybe not, but these are their prime childbearing years. The U.S. fertility rate is at a 35-year low. Some critics blame structural difficulties in the U.S. economy that make it harder for women to choose to have children. But European nations make it vastly easier for mothers and still cannot get their fertility rates above replacement. They can't even get them to barely half of replacement level. What's behind this is primarily culture. We have become an antinatalist society. And that's why, listen, this is part of the reason why there was such vigorous opposition to Amy Coney Barrett. How dare she have 7 children? How dare she? How dare she be a mother? Yesterday on the Al Mohler podcast, I talked about going to a conservative evangelical college a few years ago and hearing from professors there that they feared most of their students would never be able to form stable families because so many of them had never seen what that's like. And now we have 30% of Generation Z women claiming to be sexually uninterested in men. There's nothing remotely normal about that number. It is a sign of a deeply decadent culture that is a culture that lacks the wherewithal to survive. The most important thing that a generation can do is to produce the next generation. No families, no children, no future. We're going to have to endure a civilizational collapse before we begin the great relearning. I am beginning to see now why a sociologist I heard speak a few years ago said that losing awareness of the gender binary is going to mean the end of us. He meant that we will lose cultural memory of the basic fact needed to ensure the future of our civilization. We are living through that fall right now. 30% of women aged 25 and under have no interest in sex with men. If that does not alarm you as a religious traditionalist or conservative, then you might actually be dead. We absolutely must form right now, not tomorrow, right now, communities that socialize our children into the goodness of marriage and family. The broader culture knows what it believes, and it preaches this confidently. The churches are barely pushing back, and it shows. And then this is a screenshot. You could not play this video. A screenshot of a video celebrating abortion. And you see, where are they doing this? In a church. This is so vile. You know, I get accused, you know, you're such a downer, John. Listen, I'm only telling you what's going on, okay? If you don't like it, you know, Joel Osteen has a channel. Is he back? Are they back meeting yet? No, I'm serious. If you want that stuff, go listen to that garbage. Okay? We're about telling the truth here at Fellowship Bible Chapel. If we wanted a big audience, we would... We know what to do. Joel, look at how many people attend Joel Osteen's church. Somebody said he's got a big church but a very small denomination, which I think is an accurate assessment. Well, here's a very important story, though. Sudan is the third state to announce Israel ties. So the other day, I think it was Friday, President Trump and people at the White House announced that Sudan and Israel had begun the process of normalizing their relationship. For example, this is from Al Akbar newspaper in Lebanon. This is a Hezbollah mouthpiece. They're looking at it, and I'm trying to remember what the thing on the other thing is. I know what it says. On the left-hand side, that is Arabic, and it says, the first line says, Tel Aviv, colon, today, Sudan, tomorrow, Saudi Arabia. Now, that's from the Hezbollah mouthpiece in Lebanon. And this was big news. This is Israel Hayom newspaper and talking about it. I'll play a little bit. I think you need to listen to this, of what President Trump had to say. I think peace is good, but I also think that there are very serious implications to what is going on here with these peace accords, the Abraham Accords. I see people who think, oh, they're great. It's great. Nothing to worry about. Nothing to see here. You know, don't worry about it. And then they'll say, well, you call them, you know, I'm not going to call them evil. I don't call them evil, okay? I'm tired of people getting up when they want to listen, in Bible prophecy, we have disagreements, okay? Don't misrepresent what other people say. Don't create straw men. Argue your case. That's fine. Listen, we don't know exactly how all this is going to play out. Let me tell you this. Did anybody see this happening 4 years ago? Be honest with me. Did you see it happening? Okay, I want you to hear what President Trump said. And I'm going to play you a politician from 4 years ago, what he said. Okay, here's Trump.
The State of Israel and the Republic of Sudan have agreed to make peace. This is for many, many years they've been at odds, to put it nicely, and to normalize their relations. This will be the third country where we're doing this, and we have many, many more coming. We have, they're coming at us hot and heavy. In the coming weeks, they will meet to negotiate cooperation agreements. You saw that happen with UAE and Bahrain recently, in agriculture, technology, aviation, migration, and other critical areas. This historic deal comes just a few weeks after the groundbreaking agreement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Israel and the and Bahrain. That was very historic. That was a great day, a very historic day. Bahrain and United Arab Emirates. 3 months ago, no one thought this would be possible. Even Bibi didn't know if this was going to be possible, Bibi, right? But now Bibi's multiple Arab countries across two continents have made peace with Israel. And again, we have many lined up. They want to come in. They want to get the deal done. They all see it. No blood in the sand. I say no blood. This is one where there's been no blood in the sand. But this is a tremendous show of faith and courage and leadership, which has forged this agreement. The United States stands with all of you and all the nations that seek peace and cooperation. And again, we will be signing many nations over the next coming weeks and months, including some very big ones. It's very exciting, actually. It's peace in the Middle East without bloodshed. And it should have been done this way a long time ago. The Palestinians, by the way, if you ask about the Palestinians, they're wanting to do something. They've never seen anything like this. They're wanting to do something. I'm sure that will get done, too. Bibi, would you like to say something?
Well, I want to say that we are expanding the circle of peace so rapidly with your leadership, Mr. President, your able team. History in the making. Actually, we're all making history, from the Emirates to Bahrain, now with Sudan and other countries that are in line. I think that this truly changes the region. It changes the lives of all our peoples for the better. It allows us to focus on the task of building nations, building our future, building technology, agriculture, environment, health, everything. I think we can do it better together. And with your help, the help of the United States, the possibilities are infinite. We used to say in the Middle East, the sky's the limit, but now we don't even have that because the skies aren't limitless. We fly over Sudan, we fly over Saudi Arabia, we fly to Bahrain, we fly to the Emirates, everybody flies to us. It's just a new world, and I can't tell you how excited we are for cooperating with everyone, cooperating with Sudan to build the future, a better future for both of us. It's a glorious day for peace. I want to thank you again, Mr. President, for everything you're doing.
Thank you, Mr. President. Well, I think that today is another great example of what is possible when you have strong and smart American leadership in the Middle East and throughout the world. For those who follow the history of this conflict, the significance of this cannot be overstated enough. You have a situation in 1967, after the Six-Day War, the Arab League met in Sudan, and in Khartoum, they had the declaration of what was became known as the three no's for the Arab League. No peace, no recognition, no negotiations. Now today we have peace, we have the three yeses under President Trump. We have peace, we have recognition, and we have negotiation for even more peace. So this is a tremendous acceleration of the turning point that President Trump has been able to accomplish in the region. And I do really believe that we're seeing this pick up even more and more. We have more countries that are going to be making peace with Israel. We're very confident that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict will be resolved as well. And I do think that will allow us to focus on reducing extremism and terrorism, and then also reducing anti-Semitism throughout the world. And both of those cannot be understated enough as big accomplishments. And I will just say finally that if you look at where Sudan was in 2016 versus where they are now, again, you have a president who's not lecturing other countries, but for countries who want to improve their lot and make progress, there's no better partner than America, and that's what you're seeing with Sudan and with the Middle East. And I will just say as well that these peace agreements are not as easy as President Trump and his team are making them look. These are very hard agreements. These are conflicts that have gone on for decades in many regards. And getting people to resolve these conflicts and focus on how you can create a brighter future is just a tremendous thing that makes America safer and the world a better place. So thank you, Mr. President, for your leadership.
Now, I think from a Bible prophecy standpoint, these are big deals. That's what I think. I know there are people that disagree. That's fine. We'll see how this plays out over the coming weeks and months. But listen, this is something, this is another one of these things that we're sort of losing the ability to use the term unprecedented, because when everything is unprecedented, is anything still left that's unprecedented? I mean, you know, I So Bibi Netanyahu, this is Prime Minister Netanyahu, who gave a speech. This is in Hebrew, so you don't need to listen to it. But what he was saying was he was talking about different terrorist attacks and things that had happened. And he made reference to the fact that, look, historically, this is a big deal because United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, there really wasn't any past conflicts between Israel and those countries. But there was conflicts between Israel and Sudan. Very serious conflicts in which a lot of people died and there were attacks back and forth. And so he was sort of showing some of the things that, flying to Sudan, flying out there, you know, now he can fly over Saudi Arabia, but there were attacks. In fact, I went back and I dug out a couple of articles. On the left is, on the right is an article from March 2009. This was right at the time when, if you go and get this, this was the transition from the Omar to the Netanyahu government 11 years ago. So this happened under Olmert's government, but they were in the process of picking their academy and that type of thing, or their cabinet. For example, you can see here on the left, there's, you know, they're getting too many people in the cabinet, and I need to have a senior position, or I'm not going to do this. So nothing's really changed in Israeli politics in 11 years. But this article here, that Hamas arms convoys were hit in Sudan. Now, listen, this article is in March. The attacks on the Sudanese convoys, in which about 120 people were killed, took place in January and February. But the Sudanese government did not really announce them because they were embarrassed about what had happened. So they really didn't come out for almost 60 days before the Israeli press started talking about them. And you can see there were arms shipments that were coming to Sudan. And then those arms shipments were being taken up through to Hamas in Gaza. So this was a big deal. And then in October 2012, there was another attack. Khartoum blames Israeli airstrike for explosion at munitions plant. So there really was attacks and a state of war with Sudan. And about 6 months ago, they overthrew the Sudanese Islamist leader. This was an Islamist terror-supporting country. So President Trump came out the other day and said, we'll take you off the list if you make peace with Israel. And they did. And so now we have another country, and now there's reports that others are coming. Now, the interesting thing is, has Barack Obama come out and praised these peace agreements? Has anybody from the Obama administration or Clinton administration come out and praise these? You know, this is Obama back in this was the same newspaper back in March 2009. Status quo, unsustainable, two-state solution is critical. And everybody said, well, you're never going to get this without settling with the Palestinians. President Trump, if you move the embassy to Jerusalem, the Arab world is going to explode. If you take out a terrorist in Iran, Iran's going to explode. So my question is, has any of this happened? And bless the beauty of YouTube. I do love the resources there. Here back in October 2020. Oh, this was posted on October 2020. But this conference took place while John Kerry was at the Brookings Institution, the Saban Forum in Washington, D.C. And this is John Kerry, who was then the Secretary of State of the United States of America, talking about what would happen, what needed to happen in the Middle East.
So the question for all of us is not the road we've traveled for the last 100 years. The question is, what are the next 100 years going to look like? Where are we going? And let me tell you a few things that I've learned for sure in the last few years. There will be no separate peace between Israel and the Arab world. I want to make that very clear to all of you. I've heard several prominent politicians in Israel sometimes saying, well, the Arab world's in a different place now. We just have to reach out to them, and we can work some things with the Arab world, and we'll deal with the Palestinians. No, 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 and no. I can tell you that reaffirmed even in the last week as I have talked to leaders of the Arab community. There will be no advance and separate peace with the Arab world without the Palestinian process and Palestinian peace. Everybody needs to understand that. That is a hard reality.
Oops.
The hard reality is that Barack Obama triggered the Arab Spring. Everybody knows this. With the help of Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, and one guy named Joe Biden. So, well, the Palestinian reaction has been, as you would expect, as Abba Ibn said back in the 1950s, the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. The joint list of Arab parties in Israel has condemned normalization with Sudan. By the way, I've seen some polls that if they had another Israeli election right now, Naftali Bennett's party would get somewhere around 24 seats and the Likud would get about 27. The joint list would be way down. Even blue and white would drop from whatever they have now to 20-some, I think, down to six. It's crazy. So the Palestinians have condemned the shameful Israel-Sudan Accord about a week and a half ago on October 12th or 13th. The Palestinian Fatah, which is sort of the mainstream Palestinian party, released a video. It was a video that had been around since about 2017, but they released it on October 13th. And the reason they released it on October 13th was that was the anniversary of the day that the final illness that eventually took the life of Yasser Arafat was announced. So they wanted to commemorate this by putting up a video to commemorate their hero, Yasser Arafat. And so this video was on the palace. This is on the Facebook webpage, by the way. You know, Facebook, if you breathe the wrong way, if you're a conservative, you get banned or put in jail or you have your page deleted. So Fatah, they get to put this up, and it said, when the Arabness becomes heretical and it becomes Zionist and American, we will come to you, Jerusalem, with the Knights of Allah. Rejoice. You'll be freed of the Jews. We will redeem you. The borders between the Arabs will be broken down and we will be united. This is the Jews' graveyard. That's okay on Facebook. Ayatollah Khomeini also weighed in. Muslim nations will never accept the humiliation of compromising with the Zionist regime. If the U.S. thinks they can solve the region's problem this way, they are wrong. The status of any regime that negotiates with the usurping Zionist regime will be shaken before its nation. Now, the report is in the press is that the Mossad head has come out and said that probably Oman will enter into an agreement and maybe Morocco before the U.S. election in 9 days. The Saudi Arabians, the Mossad had said, they're right on the verge of coming on board with their peace agreement and normalizing everything. Now, one of the reasons for that might be, by the way, here's an interesting, this is the Saudi press showing the Iranian regime getting its lifeblood from Iraq. So you can kind of see how things are going between the Arab regime and Saudi Arabia and the Shiite regime and Iran. But this is a very interesting article. I really don't have time to go into it. I would recommend that you go and look it up at oilprice.com. Saudi Arabia is suffering the consequences of its failed oil price war. And this may be why the Saudis are willing to do this. 9 months on from Saudi Arabia's second major oil price war in the last 5 years, more negative consequences, this is current, are manifesting themselves. Aside from the irrevocably damaged core relationship with the United States, the permanent distress of international investors and the further alienation of many of its fellow OPEC members, Saudi Arabia is now beginning to discover the true depth and breadth of damage that has been done to its economy, which will endure for many years to come. So the interesting thing is that, you know, nobody who would think that the Saudis might go bankrupt. They got oil, right? They sit on a ton of oil, and it's fairly cheap to get out of the ground. So now they, you know, they got an oil price war, and now they're suffering the consequences of that. There was a report a number of years ago, new petro aggression in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia in the spotlight, by Thomas Richter. And essentially, this is this was released by a German intelligence agency, and the Germans immediately pulled it back. But he said, listen, this Mohammed bin Salman guy is really being kind of ruthless and reckless with the way that he's going around about things. But it says here, the careful diplomatic stance of older members of the Saudi royal family has been replaced by an impulsive policy of intervention. Mohammed bin Salman's impulsive nature had also clearly not taken into account the prescient warning from Saudi Arabia's deputy economic minister back in 2016, which stated unequivocally and completely unprecedented criticism of governmental policy from a Saudi minister that, he said this, if we, Saudi Arabia, don't take any reform measures and if the global economy stays the same, then we're doomed to bankruptcy in 3 to 4 years. The consequences of the oil price war that prompted this outburst from a Saudi minister were also apparently not taken into account by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, either now as then, who now as then appeared more concerned with his own personal position in the royal succession, given the ill health of King Salman, who's survived a number of deaths here over the last few years. It seems like every month or 2 months, King Salman died. I would highly recommend, so there's this oil thing going on, and I can see I need to stop. But listen, great article by Jonathan Speier in the Jerusalem Post on Friday, Strategic Game in the Eastern Mediterranean. You need to understand that there is a, this is very significant from a Bible prophecy standpoint about oil and gas in the Eastern Mediterranean. The Hoover Institute Strategica website has Turkey, in the Eastern Mediterranean crisis, and also an article called Crisis in the Eastern Mediterranean by Barry Strauss. And the point of all of this is that Turkey is making inroads into the Eastern Mediterranean. This is a, I showed you this last week, this is a ship called, I don't know how you say it in Turkey, Fatih, I don't know, F-A-T-I-H. It actually means conquest. Was not, the name of this was not chosen randomly. It was chosen by Erdogan and others to prove a point. And so Erdogan is running around. I mean, this is a tweet from the Turkish presidency Twitter account just this morning. Turkey will never allow the establishment of a terrorist state right beside its border. They're talking about what's going on in Syria with the Kurds. He also said this, President Recep Erdogan spoke by phone with President Rouhani of Iran, and there's a pretty good working relationship between Turkey and Iran right now, which from a Bible prophecy standpoint, we would expect there to be some cooperation. Erdogan, this is kind of an interesting graphic from, I forget which newspaper I pulled it out of, how he's sort of building his 2023 campaign by doing all this nationalist stuff and getting involved in all these other arenas. This was an article in the Financial Times I referenced last week. Strongmen battle for supremacy in the Middle East. Vladimir Putin, Erdogan, and Mohammed bin Salman have a lot in common. They're all nationalists with regional ambitions. They are autocrats who have centralized power and have been ruthless with domestic political opposition. And they are all risk takers who are happy to use military force. The interesting thing, this is the Human Rights, UN Human Rights Council, which has like the most bizarre ceiling in the world. I mean, if this is on Fixer Upper, they're like, get that thing, you know, get, that's not popcorn, that's stalactite stuff. It actually is stalactite stuff. I think they spent $2 million on that ceiling, by the way. But anyway, Saudi Arabia is now in the Human Rights Commission, Council for the UN. And I think Turkey is too. So the thugs of the Middle East are now running the Human Rights Council. That's comforting, right? Nothing bad will happen for this. France, they had this terror attack on a teacher who had referenced in his classroom these cartoons. One of the guys got upset. They doxed this guy, and he was stabbed to death. And Macron, this is Macron at the guy's funeral. There was a huge outpouring of support for him. Macron has come out and said, listen, we got to have a French version of Islam. He's dreaming. He has also come out in response to concerns about Islamists educating their children at home. He's come out and said, we're going to ban homeschooling. That's going to apply to Christians as well. I think there are 50,000 Christian kids being homeschooled. But he's come out pretty strongly. He's got an election coming up next year. He's tacking to the right. I think the election is in 2022, actually. And he's trying to get support, you know, cut off some of the nationalist parties. Erdogan responded to this, said that Erdogan, because of his opposition to this, needs a mental check. Erdogan said this, if the European countries want to preserve their positions in the global system, which is being restructured, they all must tackle the affliction of Islamophobia in their system. And then just two more things. Here is a study, this was in the Jerusalem Post the other day. European lost nearly 6% of its Jewish population in the past half century. That's after World War II. Were that they're going to Israel. If you read Bible prophecy, where would you expect them to be regathered initially in unbelief? Israel. So that's that. And then there are currently negotiations going on. This is, again, the Eastern Mediterranean. I'm trying to remember the publication that I got this graphic from. I think it was a CIA or U.S. intelligence or CIA publication about gas and oil reserves in the Eastern Mediterranean. You can see them. And you can see this area right here, this disputed block. See the border there between, in the Mediterranean, the rights of Israel and Iran, or I'm sorry, Israel and Lebanon. And they're currently having negotiations about this. The problem is that there's a disputed area. In the Israeli area in the Mediterranean, there is one of the biggest gas finds in history. Lebanon, which really needs the money, Hariri is now coming back again as the prime minister, I heard this week, but they need, the problem is in their area of the Mediterranean, they haven't found anything. So Lebanon continues to be a basket case. So listen, this is that's just a very small snippet of what I read through this week. Pray for the election, pray for safety of people. Be on your guard, because I think we're going to need to be careful. So anyway, Jesus is returning. Get out there while we still have the time and freedom. Share the gospel. The church thrived under persecution. It has for 2,000 years. So, you know, I'm not sitting here. I don't have a persecution wish or anything by any stretch of the imagination. But there are plenty of scriptures that tell us to prepare for that. So let's pray. Father, we thank you for the guidance that you've given us in your word. Lord, we thank you for the gift of your Son and the gospel of salvation by grace through faith, your Son who came to earth, lived a perfect life, was crucified, buried, and rose again on the third day, and ascended to heaven, and is returning to set up his kingdom. And we can believe in him and him alone for our salvation. We pray that you'll give us opportunities to share that great message with people and help us as we try to make disciples for Jesus. Bless us this week in Jesus' name. Amen.